Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Andrew from Tuesday Night Lambertville Group.
Lower. My name's Andrew. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, everyone, for having me here. And it's good to be here. And, there's my man in the back. Now everything's all right. So you're the man in your underwear tonight. All right. Goodness. I have a little bit of time now. I feel like there's so much I can say. I get overwhelmed when I get up to a microphone in front of a group of people who are enthusiastic about getting in contact with a power that's going to solve their problem for them. And so what I try to do is I try to utilize the phenomenon that used to be my downfall, and that's the strange mental blank spot, you know? So I get up here and I just try to let the blank spot happen. And the blank spot used to happen, but it was about on the other side of the spiritual spectrum. It can really tear me apart. I wind up putting a drink in me and not even realizing how it happened. So at any rate, assets become liabilities and vice versa. So anyway, the big book talks about an alcoholic can generally win the another confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours, and until such a point is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished, you know. And I've been told I'm only speaking for an hour, so nothing's going to be accomplished here tonight, so now's the time for everybody to, like, collectively just lower your alcoholic expectations, you know, and let me just play out this blank spot and hopefully help a few people from, ending up spiritual death. Anyway, what do we do in our stories? We hear in How It Works, we talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I actually like what There's a Solution says. It says each person in the individual stories describes in his own way and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. You know? So for me to be up here, for me to talk about why I need to have a relationship with God, I have to talk about my drinking. Because alcohol was the thing that made me realize that I need a power in my life to make it through a 24-hour period without taking a drink until I end up dead or committing homicide or suicide. So I started at the beginning, and I had like a pretty normal life growing up. Older brother, my mom's from New York by way of Puerto Rico, and my dad's from Ireland by way of Philadelphia, and I was raised, like, powerfully Catholic, because I promise you that's all my parents have in common, and they're pretty open-minded, you know what I mean? And I grew up thinking I was Italian, I don't know. I'm not Italian at all, I promise you. It's like one of those things that comes out in step five, I don't know how to explain it. So the funny thing about my growing up is that it was so normal and good that it's probably not even worth wasting your burn CDs over. It was like normal. My dad got sober when I was like 6 years old, six or seven, after a couple tries, you know, and then he went from putting holes in the walls to having poker games in the basement with other sober guys. And I never really understood what that was about, but I knew that he was changed, you know. My mother's a school teacher, you know. Like, I had a normal growing up. Like, I don't believe there was anything that ever happened to me. And not like I didn't have a free ride. Like, I wasn't just, like, easy rider style through life. Like, stuff happened that should have never happened to a kid. And then I was a teenager, and stuff happened to me that should have never happened to me, you know. But that didn't make me an alcoholic, you know. And I know that today because of the things that I've seen sober, you know. But what I do know is that I had my first drink around like 11 years old, which is not abnormal for where I'm from, you know. And it's funny because I got an effect that I didn't recognize was like unique and outstanding, you know. And all I knew was on the other end of it, like I felt horrible and I blacked out, you know. And I was young, like I don't remember falling asleep in the park, you know, but that's what happened, and apparently a bunch of stuff happened before that, and I had no immediate desire to go back to that drink. Like, it wasn't like I woke up and feel like I felt my calling, but I got this incredible effect, you know, and then eventually you can. I began to be in situations where there's just a drink available to me, and I would take that drink, you know. And then it wasn't until I was at this party with these kids, and this kid had an older brother, you know, and his older brother had all his friends there, and they kind of let us hang out with them, and it was like a party. It wasn't like 10 guys sitting around drinking. It was like there was women and men, and there was people around, and they were like socializing, you know, like, and I got there, and I was like absolutely terrified, and I think it was like 3 Coors Tall Boys, and oh man, it was like it revolutionized my whole attitude, and I just was out there in the party, being a part of, and talking to everybody, and just enjoying myself, and making jokes, you know, and like I always used to like being overly enthusiastic about things, and nobody would react the right way, or I would really put all my effort into telling a joke that didn't come out right, and oh my God, I would think about that moment for like the next 8 weeks, you know? In that moment, I would re-feel it, and re-feel it, and re-feel it, you know, over and over and over again. And this time, when I took that drink, I got this effect where none of that mattered at all. And I was completely free to say whatever came to my mind, whatever I was inspired to say, and just let it out. And it always came out right. And if it didn't, I didn't even care. You know, I felt so free. I felt like that's when I felt like I found my answer. You know, because there was stuff that happened to me when I was young, and that stuff used to sit in my head at night before I fell asleep. And the only time that stuff didn't get to me is when I had a drink, right? Because I got this effect that was later found out is actually unnatural. It's the manifestation of a physical sensitivity to alcohol that causes me to react to my first drink differently from other people. The other part of that physical sensitivity is a craving, which I knew nothing about when I was drinking until I came here and got that information. So I continue to drink because I'm realizing that, like, oh, yeah, if life just becomes too gray, alcohol is the thing that just makes it all right, you know? And then I remember one day finding the perfect mixture, and it was like 5 shots of vodka and a half a bottle of Boone's Farm, because the Boone's Farm would, like, fill me up so I wouldn't have to eat, because sometimes if you eat, you get sick, and then it would be a mess. But, like, 5 shots of that vodka and a half a bottle of Boone's Farm, you know? I felt great, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, this is like $3 a day I need, you know? That's not a bad deal to be alive and to only need $3 a day to set yourself right. Like, that's not a burdensome cocktail to need. That's not a burdensome deal. That's a good deal. And I remember thinking that, and that worked for like 3 weeks, you know? That wasn't a joke. I'm thinking like, no, that was, so yeah, 3 weeks it lasted, and it wasn't enough, you know? That wasn't enough at that point. And it's funny how alcohol evolves so quickly. I'm a chaser. Like, people say, oh, I was out there looking for things. I'm like, I wish I was looking for it. Looking for it is when that thing you're looking for sits still. Chasing is when you're trying to find something and it's somehow moving the hell away from you all the time, skillfully moving away from you. So I'm this chaser, and I can't find this damn concoction anymore. And I continue to look for it, and I would try to control it and enjoy it, like they talk about in the book. I love how they couple words. When they couple two words, you better pay attention, dude, because they're meaning something there, like perfect and enlarge, you know? Grow and maintain. Growth and maintenance. Like, those are two different things independently, but you put them together, that means you got to get it, keep it, and grow it, or it means nothing. Same thing with the drink. I couldn't perfect and enlarge my drinking. It just got worse. And then I would try to, but then something would happen in my life. Like, let me think for an example. I used to be in a band. I was like 15 years old. I auditioned to be in a ska band, and I got in. I've been playing guitar like since I was 10. And they had a 4-show tour set up from like here to Pittsburgh. And it's like from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. And it was like 4 or 5 shows. And I was 15. My mother was not letting me go on the show with these punk rockers. You know, like, they showed up at the house, like, you know, in an E-line van with, like, tattoos on their necks and Doc Martens, you know, like, green mohawk, the whole deal, right? And the bass player, somehow, this genius, right, convinced her, like, to let me go. And I have no idea what he said to her. And I was so impressed with this guy, you know. He wasn't like a punk. He was like actually trying to get a record deal, and he was pretty organized, and he was articulate. And I'm like, dude, my mom's from like Manhattan. She's poor. Like, you don't understand like how she's gonna come at you. Like, I know you think, good luck. That's all I'm saying. And he, like, a matter of syllables, he's like, yeah. She said yes. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. Ego was like out of control. Ego from like the second I got in that van, you know, like I'm this young guy in this band. And we drive out. The first show was like, I guess are we near Carlisle, PA? I've been driving for like an hour and a half through Land O'Lakes out here. I'm like, so we drive like 4 hours. We get out in this parking lot, and it's like just loaded with punk rockers as far as you can see, you know, and the band name was on the side of the spray paint. So I get out, and my stage name was like Super Fresh, you know, and I'm like, yeah, Super Fresh is here, you know, And then one of you's like, you guys from Hippopotamus? We're like, yeah. He's like, which one of you is Little Andy? I'm like, I am. He goes, dude, tell your mom to stop calling my house and asking me where you are. And I was like, so you go from trying to have a drink to just tolerate or to relieve the thoughts that. To now I have this humongous resentment and this horrible insecurity in front of all these people. I got to play now in front of these people. I was so deflated and then I remembered, like, the guy used to do a show with the moonshine. He would take some and breathe fire, like, between songs. And it was in the bass pedal in a pillow, and I went right for that pillow. And it took, like, two, one, two, three to get that stuff down, but... That did the trick, and I wound up breaking PA equipment that night, getting kicked out of the band, not playing well, and because with alcohol, there goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. But I remember sometimes I would just be justified to get really wrecked, you know, and that seemed to happen a lot. High school was that way. It's just I would look at somebody in the face. They don't even have to know me or think anything about me. They could be looking at the person behind me. Everything gave me this horrible reaction, and it was just, the only thing that would, like, get me out of that spiral was a drink, and I chased alcohol so bad, like, by the time I was 16, I could not go to school anymore, and if I didn't have a drink, I wasn't going. I needed, like, somebody came across this huge thing of airplane bottles of Crown Royal whiskey, and at least I had to have one of them, you know? At least. I remember drinking them in the bathroom and then teacher walking in and just putting it on my hands and putting it on like it was aftershave or something, you know, and running the hell out of there. And before he smelled my breath in the air, and I eventually dropped out. I dropped out of high school at 16 because the alcohol became paramount to all other interests. Paramount. That was the first word I ever looked up in the big book, at a big book study. Every other time I was too embarrassed to ask this guy what it meant. But they put the big book there, we're reading it, and then they had the dictionary, and I missed the whole important next paragraph about the allergy, but I'd read Paramount, I know what that means. So I'm dropped out, and now this was like time to drink, you know. I got my license, and I lost it like 4 months later. Not for driving while intoxicated, it was like driving under the influence. I was exhausted. I was up for like two nights on a run, and I dropped somebody off that I had never met at Newark Airport and was driving home and came to like going 5 miles an hour on the rivets on the turnpike, and a cop pulled up right behind me, and I could barely even keep my eyes open, you know. I continued to drink, and my buddy's friend lived in Center City, Philadelphia. We used to take the train down there and used to go to Old City, and his brother used to let him drink, and we used to just get in so much trouble in the street at night, going out with half a load. Like, I didn't care what I said to who or what I did. I just became like, whatever inspired me in the moment, I did it, you know? And as an alcoholic, I would get all kinds of weird inspirations. And apparently, don't ever mess around near 5th and Chestnut, because all that stuff is federal property, apparently. The Independence Hall and stuff. Anyway, Liberty Bell, too. It's all federal. So it started getting really dark. Like, my drinking started getting really dark. And I woke up. I didn't have the drink I needed. My mother confronted me. We had a pretty nasty argument. And I was taking college bonds that were being built up by my family. And I was signing them off and getting money to, like, get through 24-hour periods of getting where I needed to go, putting gas in a car I wasn't licensed to drive, getting around. And they, a lot of them were just starting to be gone, and she found this out, and she confronted me, and we had this really horrible discussion. And they had tutors coming home to see me at school for school so I could still graduate, and I couldn't stay sober for these guys to show up. And one of them just stopped showing up right away. It was this woman. She was an older woman, and she just wasn't. She wasn't charmed by me one bit. And then there was a math teacher who was, like, just there to do his job, and he kind of didn't notice. And another guy, like, was, you know, you can't be in this condition when I come here. It's a waste of my time, and it's a waste of your time. Okay, I promise tomorrow. Like, it's just, like, oh, it's actually from the night before. Like, it was a family event, you know. And he showed up, and I was. And he said, I'm not going to go anymore. I'm not going to tell them why, but I'm not going to continue to come here. And then eventually the math teacher stopped, and so that was a big deal. My mom was confronting me about that, and I have no power to do anything about that stuff. It's just happening around me. I'm just getting my next drink, and I have no power to stop any of this stuff. And I don't understand why this is happening to me. And you ask me, and I become irritated, and I refuse to talk, you know. Or like they say in the Jack Alexander article, we have a propensity for fencing with other people, you know, so we can get out of the argument. And that's what I did. I fenced with everybody. And I don't even know what the hell answer I'm giving. I'm just trying to make you feel bad. At any rate, the fight just got worse and worse, and it got physical. And I crossed the line. And I left home, and I went to go get a drink. I needed a drink. I went and got the drink, right? It was Wild Turkey bourbon. I remember that. And it was a lot of Wild Turkey bourbon, you know? Like, there was enough to take in the car with me afterwards and have it the next day. And I drank a lot of this bourbon, and I got drunk, but I didn't feel better. And that was a scary thing for me. And my father called a friend of mine, and he said, after what he saw that I did to my mother, he said, if you see my son, tell him when I see him, I'm not going to treat him like a kid who disrespected his mom's. I'm treating him like a man who disrespected my wife. And so I didn't go home. And like 9 months passed. I took the car. I went to Seaside Heights, New Jersey to kind of like breathe in the salt air. And I wound up robbing a house and sleeping there. And I stayed robbing houses for 9 months down there by myself, bringing people's property back. And if you've ever been to Seaside Heights in the winter, it's a ghost town. I thought, this is perfect. I can drink the way I want, you know. And I would break into a house, take the alcohol, take the property, sell it in Trenton, New Jersey. Drive back down there like 4 o'clock, park. You didn't have to pay the meters. And drink and eat. You know, eat a hot dog from 7-Eleven and drink. And then at like 4 in the morning, I would go out on the beach in my T-shirt, freezing cold, and go break into a house. And I did that for 9 months, you know. I couldn't believe how much time went by. It was like, it felt like so fast. Like, I'm the kind of guy, my experience through life is kind of, like, slow and aware. This is just gone, 9 months. And no school, no job, nothing. Just, like, a pawn shop, the guy at the 7-Eleven, and empty houses. And so the summertime came around. It was, like, Memorial Day 1997, and people started repopulating the shore like gangbangers. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, one day, there's, like, cars parked on both sides of me. I'm, like, in my underwear in my car, like, what the hell's going on? And finally, I'm, like, I got to get the hell out of here, you know? So I drive out to Yardley, PA. I was, like, past Philadelphia. And I was going up towards Trenton, and I needed a drink so bad. I'm, like, you know, I'm going to rob a house. And I found a house, and it was, like, 10 in the morning. I'm, like, I'm going to wait until night. And I waited a little while. I drove to where you can park in Morrisville and see the city of Trenton on the other side. And I sat there and I waited. I'm like, I have to wait till sundown, you know. And I couldn't wait. I was like shaking, and I was I was sick, and I was so restless. My mind was going a million miles an hour. I was blaring the radio, smoked a whole pack of cigarettes, and I was like, grabbing the steering wheel and all that stuff, because I knew I was going to get caught, you know. And I went and I did it, and I got caught right in their back window. And like 2 hours later, somebody crossed the street saw me and just wrote my plate down, gave it to a cop. But I actually left there, and I was ready to surrender, so I decided to go home and just knock on the door and just take it how it comes, you know. And my grandmother was there. My parents were in New York City for a wedding, and she was there to guard the house. Like, she had a to-do list, like, water the plants, feed the cat, keep that kid away from the house, you know. That's grandma's to-do list. And she said, "I'm not letting you in. The cops are here looking for you." And I was like, "All right, time to go back to Center City." And I got arrested on the way there. I got locked up, and they sent me to a rehab because they found all kinds of stuff in my car. And I thought I was a goner. Like, I was like, there's no way I'm not doing time, you know. They sent me to this place in, like, actually probably wasn't too far from here. It was the Terraces in Effort of Pennsylvania. Maybe it is kind of far from here. I don't know. I'm kind of out of my element here. They sent me out there, and rehab was like, it's one of those places where this van picks you up, and you get there, and there's all these signs posted on the drive up the mountain, and they're like, you know, leave your baggage here, and oh my God, this stuff made me want to throw up, like one platitude after the other. Rehab was just so painful for me. There's one guy I used to commit crime with, and I called him when I was out of detox. I'm like, if you don't bring me a care package to this rehab, I am going to take that plea bargain. I am not even 18 yet. I will rat you out. I will talk to that prosecutor like tomorrow on the phone. Like, I have their number. He's like, whoa, don't act hasty. You know, like, I'll bring you whatever you want. Just tell me where you are. I'm like, it's 3.5 hours from Philadelphia. He was like, you're out of your mind. He's like, no, I'll be there. And then I sneak out of the rehab at like 3 a.m. I go down the hill past the stupid platitudes. I go to this thrift store that was like partly supporting the rehab or something. And there's an abandoned 18-wheel back of a truck, and I hide underneath it under the spare tire. And I'm just sitting there waiting, like the sun's coming up, and this guy is like supposed to flash his lights and all that stupid stuff, and I'm waiting for him. I told him exactly where it was, you know, and like ran 2 miles down the road to a Dairy Queen. I'm like calling him, collect, he's not answering. I'm smashing the payphone like this and just freaking out, because what happens when I stop drinking is I realize like all the chaos that's going around me. Because what happens when I'm drinking is that I don't recognize true from the false. This is the only normal life I got, you know? That seems the only normal life. You get sober and you start looking at it with a little bit of the fog lifted, and it's like a different deal. It's not pretty. And the problem is, like, okay, I can handle this, right? But if I don't have 2 or 3 drinks, I can't come up with a plan, you know? That's how I lubricate my mind. Like, that's how I get things going. Like, that's where things start. That's where ideas come from. Inspiration. I need a couple of drinks to feel that way. Otherwise, an alcoholic mind state in sobriety is like the condition of persistently regretting the future, you know? I cannot foresee how anything positive will ever work out, you know? But I try. I try so hard. I make so many arrangements, you know? And I had nothing. I had no plan. I had no idea where I was going to go, but I went through the rehab and, you know, you get in the system and they start suggesting things and telling you where to go and what to do. And I started doing all that stuff and I got out of there. I didn't have to do time. It was like pretty intense probation for a handful of years and like checking in and urine tests and all that stuff and mandated to go to AA and have my little slip signed, you know. And I did all that and things started to get better. I eventually confronted my parents and they let me back in and, you know, I did all that, you know. And, yeah, it was, you know, I actually went back to high school, too, and that started to happen for me. And then all the stuff that happens when you stop drinking, like you get a haircut, you get like $20 in your pocket, you know what I mean? Like, you get a checking account, and, you know, I'd gotten to this driving school to get like the 12 points taken off my license and just look to start to get on the road to get a license again. You know, I was going to AA meetings. I did a 90 and 90 and all that stuff, and that's the stuff that we do when we come around, you know, and I had absolutely no knowledge what was wrong with me. None. Now comes the good part, where I tell you what's really wrong with me, and I tell you what it was like finding that out. At 3 years of sobriety, I tried to commit suicide. I was in Trenton, New Jersey, trying to buy a pistol. Somebody beat me for the money. It was a damn starter pistol in a pillowcase. That's demoralizing. That's what they're talking about. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's not from being drunk. That's from what happens in sobriety. So what happened in those 3 years? I was actually doing good. I decided at some point that, like, I saw people in AA, and especially the guys that were doing well. Somehow I associated sobriety and, like, all that good stuff that happens at, you know, like, at the diner, you know. Like, that was about good living, you know. So I decided that sobriety was going to be about good living, you know. And the big book was like, ha-ha, been there, done that. We call that victim of the delusion, that you could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if you only manage well. So I was trying to manage well. I was trying to go to school and, like, go to college, because somehow that will allow this group of people to look at me this way, but I'm still going to do this stuff and steal and, like, blah, 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 and that's going to allow this group of people to look at me that way, and I'm going to get a girlfriend, and she's going to have 25% of their ideas, and she's going to be there, and I'm going to see her 3 nights a week, and I'm going to get a tattoo, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to live with this guy in sobriety, because that's like, and all this stuff that I tried to make happen. And I'll tell you what happened. The girl and I that I was with, she had a trip to go to see her friend in Boston. She invited me to go. We get in her Mercury Lynx, and we drive up there, and it was, car breaks down. We were in traffic on GW Bridge for like 91 hours, I think it was, or something ridiculous like that. We get there, I'm like, I become inconsolable when I get a resentment and I have no answer for it. Inconsolable. You can't talk to me. Everything's frothy and emotional, and it doesn't work. It has no depth and weight. I just want to kill you when you talk to me. Get out of my face. I don't want to hear it. Like, why do you have this car? This car sucks. Why the hell did you leave at 5 o'clock on a Friday to go to Boston from Philadelphia? Are you out of your mind? You know? And then as soon as I leave, I was like Columbus. Like, I had a map of Philadelphia, and then if you went past where the SEPTA bus went, that's where I just drop off into nothing. You know what I'm saying? Because if you annoyed me and I had to get the hell away from you, I needed to get on a bus and put a token in there and get out of there. I can't do that in Pembroke, Massachusetts. That means I want to kill you or steal this car. I don't know how to tell you what happens to me when I stop drinking. That's what it looks like. That's not what they talk about in The Promises. That's not any of that stuff. And it got worse. Her family's friend's mom showed up and split the hotel with us. Oh. And she wanted to go to a wax museum the next day. And we had to go. And her friend's little brother was there, punk. And we're having this argument. Like, it came to a head. We picked up her friend, and her friend had this guy there. And this guy just made me really insecure and uncomfortable. He was a fan of fish. And he drove us, because our car was broken down, which got towed, with my 2-year AA chip in it. And he drove us back to this hotel, and he invited us out to some party, and then we stopped at a diner, and I just was crawling out of my skin, and I wanted to put a gun in my mouth. And I'm trying to call anybody I can in AA on the phone, because that's what we do. And I'm out in the payphone, just not even being a part of what's going on. And she comes out and she says, you know, you're really being rude. And she's like, what's the matter with you? I don't know. I didn't know. But I become irritated and refuse to talk. But what I said to her, you know, I'll say this. Her father was most likely a candidate for what we have here. But he took his life in her house when she was 14. And I said to her in the parking lot, from that state, being batted around like a kid by this disease, I said to her, the reason your dad did that is because the women in your family drive men crazy. Yeah. And she turned around and she walked away. And I turned around and I walked away. And I hitched a ride to the T station in South Boston. I got money for the T train. I went to the South Station. I got on a train to Trenton. And that's when I tried to do my thing, because I couldn't figure out why life was impossible. And I loved AA. There was great people here. But I just didn't think, like, what was wrong with me was part of the answer that you guys had. There was something else wrong with me. I heard the term outside help a lot, and that's what I connected with. People here say you need outside help. Don't ask me about outside help. I don't know what the hell that is. But I thought I needed outside help. And I tried to do this thing, and it didn't work out. And I tried option B, which was enough to end my life, and I just was too scared to do it for the fear that it wasn't enough to end my life, and I'd end up standing over my mom again after round two. See, what happens to me if you tell me that I can't take a drink and you make me believe that, I become that guy from Clockwork Orange. Right? Like, they send him back out into the world to deal with it, and he has no defense. And then he jumps out the window, you know? Stop it, I beg you, stop it. He doesn't know how to deal with it. He just has no defense, you know? His body can't handle what his mind can't live without, and that was me. And I had no idea that's what this thing is all about. So I went back to Philadelphia, and I was demoralized, and I went to my sponsor's house, and I banged on his gate, and he let me in, and I was just in tears, and he's like, what's the matter? And I told him what happened, and I opened my bag, and I showed him what I bought, and he threw it down the toilet, and he was like, tomorrow we're going to go back to the meetings, and we're going to get you a commitment, and we're going to get back on track. We're going to do what we do. And I'm like, you don't understand, though, because that's not going to work for me. You don't understand. I got, like, almost 3 years of sobriety, you know? I have 3 years of sobriety almost. This is ridiculous. You know, there's people with less time than that who, you know, they have these gifts in their lives, and they just are happy. And so he said, well, we're going to do that. And that wasn't my answer. And we went upstairs on his balcony, and we were watching the traffic go by. And this guy who I just seen around was riding his bike by, and he looked up. He saw me. He's like, hey, how you doing? What's going on? What's the matter? He's like, are you upset? He's like, I'm coming up. I'm like, no. And I'm explaining to Raymond, don't let that guy. And he rings the buzzer, and Raymond's like, just let him up, you know, like, you know, fellowship for a while. And this guy comes up, and I tell him, I just tried to end my life. He goes, of course you did. It's like, what are you talking about, you freaking nature? Like, did you hear what I said? He's like, yeah, of course you did. Like, yeah, I know. I've seen you around. I know the deal. I know what's going on with you, man. And he's like, you're a good guy, man. Where you got to go after this? I said, I got to go to my brother's. He's like, well, that's like 3 miles, 19th Captain. Let's take a walk. Come with me. I'll tell you some stuff. And this guy is like really big guy in Philadelphia. Go down to Philly and ask for GBJ. And he's also an opera singer, which is cool because he has like this very bassy, deep, like, inspiring voice, you know, and like you just want to listen to him every word he says. And he's got this cool lifestyle. Like, everything he does is just inspiring, you know. And he doesn't see it. He's crazy. He just does it. He just goes around being Jim all day. And he explained to me that I have this thing that, yeah, eventually life's going to become impossible. And he pointed out to me, and I think it was a vision for you, the jumping off point. He's like, oh, I'm so glad to meet you at the jumping off point. I'm like, jumping off point? What the hell are you talking about? I tried to get a gun. I didn't stand on the edge of a building. He goes, no. It's a point in our literature where they talk about a person who will recognize the fact that he can't drink safely anymore. And then when he realizes he can't drink, he'll realize he can't stand sobriety safely. And then he'll realize that he's at the end. And there you are. And I'm like, what the hell do I do? And he explained to me about the two awesome doctors of AA, Dr. Young and Dr. Silkworth. And he started breaking down some AA history for me. Because for me to understand really what in the hell I was doing here in this meetings, it got outside help issues, blah, 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 all kinds of stuff you hear in here. He said, well, why don't we take it right back to the foundation of where this thing started and how and why, and then in that you are going to see the most stripped down basic principle of what it is we do here and what your problem is and how I can help through what I've done. And he explained to me about Dr. Silkworth. He said, back in the 30s, if you had a drinking problem, if you had more money and you knew what to do with and can afford a good answer, they would send you to a place called Towns Hospital, because this was the leading doctor treating alcohol addiction. His name was Dr. Silkworth. And he was only giving belladonna and hydrotherapy and giving these guys exercise, and he was sending them back out into the world. And then there was a certain type of those people that he treated who always came right back in the back door. I need more hydrotherapy, belladonna, and physical exercise, please. What happened? I just sent you out. You were as sober as you were going to get. Because apparently getting as sober as you're going to get takes about 2 weeks. Right? And he says, well, okay. Because he was a sweet man. But that's the best answer you could get for your body in the 30s. That's the best you could get. So then there was one guy who was this big socialite from New York, Roland H. And he had a problem and he couldn't solve it. He was an embarrassment to his rich family. So they were like, after he exhausted all the best doctors of the mind in the U.S., they sent him to Europe. And they were like, there's this guy, Carl Jung, and he's the man over there. So you might want to go over to him and get treatment for about a year. He's going to set you right. Come back, you'll be good to go. Best doctor in the world right there, at your fingertips. And the best doctor's answer was, get a bodyguard, Roland, because a year of treatment amounted to you getting drunk on the way home to America. And that was with unusually high confidence. Don't laugh. I understand that. I get that, right? Just at the moment when everyone's hopes are starting to come up, he's going to rise himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. There's no such thing as that happy day. Not only do I believe it, all the people around me who are non-alcoholic believe it. This disease is like the mastermind, you know? It's crazy. It's so powerful. The stuff other people around me believe is going to happen, and it never does. And it always falls down right at the moment where they just have faith again. And they call that a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. That's how I drink. That's how I pull the structure down on my head, you know? Like a guy in AA, I asked him today, how was your honeymoon? He says, great, I didn't ruin most of it. I said, dude, I know exactly what you mean. And the guy next to me is like, that's ridiculous, you know? I'm like, of course it is. You're not an alcoholic. You go to your honeymoon to love your wife and have a good time, you know? Like, we go there to you know, because we end up there and then we have to find God to make it happen. It's part of our growth. So anyway, so Jim starts explaining this to me, and I'm like, I'm that guy. And he says, so the best doctor of the mind, and Carl Jung, told this guy, you have to get a bodyguard. But what they both said at the same time, which is miraculous to me, the one doctor of the body was like, there's a type who's hopeless. The guy who drinks and I get him sober, he always comes back in the back door. He needs, I guess you could call it moral psychology. But I don't know how to give that to you, dog, because I'm a doctor. If you need a pill, come see me. But other than that, I don't know how to give you moral psychology. But yeah, that's what you need. And then the doctor of the mind in Europe was like, yeah, the guy came back and said, what do you mean get a bodyguard? I had the best, you're the best doctor in the world. There has to be one answer. And he pressed him, you know, he manipulated him and he given him the whole truth and he got it. And the whole truth was this. Yeah, there's a type of people like you who drink that way and they cross a line and that's beyond human aid and they don't come back from it. But some people, once in a while, for reasons that we don't know, understand, and God help us that we could never harness this, they have these amazing awakenings and the attitudes that used to drive their life and define who they were are just gone. Gone. Like a phenomenon of lightning. And I have absolutely no idea how to give that to you. Your best bet is to go align yourself with church or anywhere that's practicing spirituality, and hopefully you'll turn yourself into a little spiritual phenomenon conductor and get struck by the lightning that's going to recover you from the hopeless state of mind and body. So he went to the Oxford group, and they had a little six-step program, six tenets, and they were going to get people not sober. It wasn't designed for alcoholics. It was just for people to become spiritual and live a different way of life. But he brought that message to a guy named Ebby, and Ebby brought that to Bill in the hospital. And Bill was that guy. Thank God he was that guy who had that thing happen to him in that hospital. He had it happen to him. And the manifestation of the phenomenon was while he lay in the hospital peacefully, the thought came that I wonder if other people would be glad to have what I just had. And that's why I'm standing here and you all are sitting here, because that thing happened. So now the beautiful thing about if you're an alcoholic after 1939 is that it's no longer this ridiculously unobtainable phenomenon to have a psychic change, because 100 people got sober and they had a way out on which they all agreed that you could recover from that hopeless state of mind and body, that physical sensitivity of allergy that compels you to continue to drink, and this obsession of the mind and this wretched, wretched spiritual malady that just pokes your brain like a rat in a cage all day until your life becomes so rotten sober that it's not worth staying sober for anymore, until you have to have the ease and comfort of a drink. And all you can remember is the first time you got that ease and comfort. And I would kill somebody to have it if I'm in the jackpot. I would kill somebody to have it. And that's my problem. That's alcoholism. But thank God these 100 people wrote this book and outlined exactly what they did. And they packaged it in an attractive way and they laid it at our feet. They didn't shove it down our throats. It's for me to decide. They even go so far as to say, the first thing is to decide that you're this guy. Because there's all kinds of funny drinking behavior out there in the world, but we are a special breed right here. You know what I'm saying? You can't tell how we are from how we drink. You have to watch what happens when we have a week sober. That's how you know that we're on. That's how you know we're around the corner. You know what I mean? You can't tell what's going on with us with a drink. You have to watch what happens when we don't have the drink. So Jim says, you know, so that's what we do here. You know, we get an answer, and it's outlined here. And forget everything you hear in the meetings. You can hear one thing to the other in the meetings. But that's where AA came from. You know, this guy was convinced we needed to have a spiritual awakening to recover from the condition that you're suffering from. And I did it, and I had it, and I'm willing to lay it at your feet. And I asked him to sponsor me. And he used the word that Dr. Silkworth used when Bill asked to sponsor guys. He said he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his stories to other patients. And Jim said it would be a privilege and an honor. And he took me through the steps, took me through 2 and 3 pretty quick, you know. And then he showed me how selfishness and self-centeredness is really the root of the problem. I had no idea. My life was just a series of wasting my energy making arrangements that weren't working out. My God. And then he had me introduce me to the inventory. Man, I'm running out of time. Anyway, but I got to tell this story about the inventory, because the inventory is a very simple 4-column chart that looks like something you'd learn in like 3rd grade. It looks like introduction to phonics. It's like so remedial. I thought I was going to get this like incredibly intellectually satisfying psychological insight about myself from the 4th step, you know, and that I was going to walk away with a self-knowledge that, you know, just became the fuel of my seamless existence. And it was a stupid ass chart. A stupid little chart. He said, now what did you do, what defect do you have there? Pick from the 5: inconsiderate, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. I had to learn the definition of those. So I'll give you a stupid example of an inventory that this is the catalyst. I had a roommate. I was in college at the time, and I had $0, right? I had no money. And so this guy, he woke up one morning. His name was Jared. He was the best roommate I ever had. Sarah knows him. And he woke up one morning with this horrible swollen throat. He could barely talk. He was dying. And I used to buy 12 packs of Cherry Cokes, because at night when I don't have money to eat and I would need to study, it would just fill me up, keep me awake, keep me from having an appetite, and like let me go to bed, wake up, or, you know. So it was like $4 for the 12-pack, which is kind of a splurge for me back then. So I had this 12-pack. It was like this beautiful-looking purple and red thing in the fridge, you know. It's got like 11 left, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm thinking about these things in my head. And he wakes up. He's all dying. I'm like, I'm going to class. I'm like, dude, you know, help yourself, man. If you're sick, just help yourself. So I go home. I come back. They're all gone. All of them are gone. The box is still in there, empty. I'm like, man, it sucks. It sucks. So I write it down because it was stupid. Like, I'm not afraid to look at that part I played in that. That's a stupid thing to be upset about. But I honestly didn't think I did anything wrong, so what do you do with it? It's a resentment. Somehow I have to be free of these things so I can allow this power to come in and expel all the nuttiness. You know what I'm saying? So I write it out. I'm resentful at Jared. Why? Drank all my Cokes. Affects my pride. Why you got to do that to me? Why you got to take advantage? Self-esteem? And I asked myself, why would he do that to me? You know, ambitions to like study, have coke, not be hungry, affects my financial security. It's stupid, I know, believe me. So we get to the fourth column. Now this stupid list holds the key to the future. I have to turn back to it and find my own part. I have to disregard what he did entirely. I have to have a whole revolutionized outlook on this resentment. I don't know how to do that. So Jim's walking me through, and he's like, you know, we look at what we do. We look at our part. I'm like, yeah, well, I was being a nice guy. You know, I was telling him to take what he wanted. He's like, well, what did you say to him? I said, take what you want. And he's like, well, that's what he did. You know? I said, so what are the five things? He goes, yeah, dishonest is one of them. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, he told me an experience he had where he would show up to meet people and they'd be gone. And he'd be like, they stood me up. And then they would call him back and say, no, you said 10 minutes, which is 600 seconds. And you showed up 38 minutes later. I don't know what the math is, but you get what I'm saying? Like, and then I would call Jim and say, like, I would do that too to him. Like, yeah, I'll be there in 10 minutes. Whoa, don't hang up yet, dummy. Where are you? 4th and Spring Garden, that's Silk City. I'm on 19th and Chestnut. You're not going to be here in 10 minutes. I'm like, well, Jim, 10 minutes is an expression. He's like, yeah, I get it. So okay, see you in 10 minutes. Otherwise, I'll not be here. I'm like, I'll see you in 25 minutes, Jim. He's like, awesome. I'll be here, you know, because I don't understand that I'm not even telling the truth. I don't get it. I never looked at myself. Here's something else. He says, so why did you say that to him? It's easy, because when you say something like that to somebody, they look at you a certain way. They look at you like you're the man, like you're this nice guy. You know, people receive charity well in this world, you know. That's how I want to be seen. But I don't want to make the sacrifice, stupid. That's the whole game. He says, yeah, now look back at your inventory. Everywhere. I was dumbfounded over this stupid resentment, over these stupid cokes. $4. Stupid. And then when I did my inventory in the amends, I owed Jared an apology because he said, hey, you got four friends hanging out in the living room. It's kind of late. I got work tomorrow, but I don't want to ruin your time. Here, take my car. Have a good time. You know, I got work tomorrow morning, and, you know, that way you guys can get out and I don't have to ruin your party. So I come back from Caesars in Atlantic City at about 5:14, and he leaves at about 5:15. And he sees the parking receipt, and I owe an amends. And I tell my sponsor this. He's dying. He's like, he did the same thing with the cokes. It's hilarious, you know? I don't see it. So I did this inventory, and there's all this stuff I've never seen. I don't have to plan how to get rid of it. I don't have to plan how it's not going to show. I don't have to hide it. I don't have to stuff it down there. I ask for it to be removed. But what if there's good stuff about me that, like, being a manipulator is a great way to reach a newcomer, you know what I'm saying? And he says, well, it says here, we ask for the good and bad to be removed. Because I don't even know the difference anymore. I'm out of my mind. I don't know the difference. God, how about you take it all? Okay, there's a growth period that has to happen now. What do I do when the growth period's going on? Easy. You make a list of all the people that you harmed doing that stuff you had no idea you were doing. And you get in front of them. And you focus on that. And you don't worry about what's going to happen, all that crap you found in your fourth step and all that terrible stuff you told me in your fifth step. It's not going to matter. Just move forward. You know? Take these actions with me. And so I'll talk about this one amends I made, and I'll wrap up. I wrote a letter to the last house I robbed, because you don't make that amends in person, I don't think. And that was pretty, like, easy. So I write this letter, and the letter was like, I bring it back to Jim. And the letter was like, dear residents of Holly Hemlock Road in the suburbs, I'm sorry I broke into your house and stole all the property out of it and, you know, and got arrested later, but and everything was returned, to my understanding. But I'm sober now, and I'm in AA, and I'm deeply sorry for having done that to you. I've enclosed a check for your window, and I also know a guy in AA who is a pharmacist, and he told me the actual cost of the prescription I stole, and that money order is enclosed herein. You know, good luck in your life. Thank you so much. And he was like, with his head in his hands, like, And Jim loves alcoholics like you wouldn't even believe. He loves all the funny, crazy stuff we come up with. He embraces how ridiculously sick I am. He loves it. He gets such a kick out of it. He's like, that's awesome, that letter. It's so bad that it's like awesome. Like, this is like, it's so powerfully wrong that it's just awesome. I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like that guy who uses the scalpel of truth with the anesthetic of love, you know? I could always hear what he was telling me. And he told me, well, this is really about getting unblocked so that that power that you see in me and other people can come and be a part of your life so that you don't have to live the way you used to be living. And you don't know this yet, but you have to trust my experience that you can't live with that stuff and have this power at the same time, because that's a rule I know about and that's a rule that you don't know about yet. But that's what I'm telling you. So for you to get clear of that stuff, you have to know what harms you were doing. I said, I did. I said, I'm sorry I broke into your house. I'm sorry. He said, you talked mechanically about what you did, but you never recognized what happens when a person who has kids comes home and their house is robbed. You don't know what that looks like. You don't know what it's like to be the neighbor of the person on both sides and across the street. There's three more people and families who see cop cars and wonder what the hell's going on. Or you don't know what it's like to find the jewelry missing. You know, I wasn't aware that the cops brought it back before the people called it in. They could think this stuff is like, who knows where. You know, family heirlooms. I have no idea what that moment, that free fall was like for them. I have no idea what it's like to legally be prescribed to the pills I took. I'd taken a lot of them, but I was never prescribed to them. So I have no idea what it feels like to actually need those things. So I don't know what it's like when you go for them and they're not there. But that's what I did, and I had no idea. And I was dumbfounded. It was the same revolutionary change in outlook on my inventory that I had on these harms. And I said, well, I don't know how to write a letter to apologize for that because that's a lot of stuff. He said, I know it is. And I said, Jim, I don't even want to think about it. And he says, I know, because I don't either. You know, but we must. We have to. Actually, in step 8, it talks about, remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would have to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol, you know? So I went home, and he said, but I'll tell you this, like, I'm not God, so I don't know what's good for me sometimes, so I can't tell you what's best for you, but I do know that if you're having a problem, if you're agitated or doubtful, ask for help. Sit still and ask for help. Get quiet and see what happens. So I went home, and I got on my knees, and I asked God to help me write this letter. And I had my experience that made me a free man. I was different from that moment. I don't want to scare any newcomers away, but felt like my chest came outside of my body. Felt like my heart caught fire. Felt fearless for the first time in my life. I got up. I wrote the right letter, packaged it, and sent it. Next day, I got in front of 2 more people. Next day, I got in front of more people. Next day, I got halfway through that list. And that's been the case for the last 13 years. I haven't had a drink since June 12th, 1997. I haven't had a thought about a drink since that night I wrote that letter. You know, it's no coincidence. Like, you can't get AA through osmosis sitting in here just listening to the message. That book is an action-packed instruction manual. Trust me. So now what? I call Jim. I tell him about this experience, and in his genius, he tells me, dude, that's temporary. I say, you son of a bitch. You son of a bitch. That's temporary. I said, okay, what do I do now? We gotta get into more action. Now that you have that power, the first resentment you have is gonna take it away. And that's gonna happen because of who we are.